Hello and welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing you a program dedicated to the life of the mind. In this one, we visit Stanley Farley, painter and sculptor. I visited Stan at his studio near Eagle Hawk in Victoria. It's a favourite of mine as a study or studio, but also as a bush shack, another subject I'd like to go into one day. His studio is built around an old railway carriage planted in the Whipstick Forest amongst the red ironbarks and old gold diggings, the choughs and babblers, and the wind in the trees.
The first thing that I really remember was the delight in learning to read, and it's very vivid to me. I must have been about to start school, or just started primary school. There weren't a lot of books in the house, but I remember learning to read out of a reader, lying on my... I remember clearly the delight that realising that the words meant something and you could string them together to make more meanings. And I was very lucky about around about 5 or 6 at the time that I started school, or even before I started school, the house that my parents had, my mother gave a room to her school teacher, the woman that had taught her, Miss Campbell, was a single genteel white-haired lady, and lived in a room in the house, and I was allowed, if I'd been a good boy, before I went to bed, was to go into Miss Campbell's room, and she'd sit me on a wicker chair and give me a big dictionary. I think it was Webster's Dictionary, with all the little drawings, engravings in it. And she'd let me look at it, sometimes unattended, but often she'd talk to me about it. I wasn't reading the words, I was looking at the pictures, and she'd talk about perhaps what the picture was illustrating. And that was so, so wonderful that I'd look forward a lot of the day to an evening. If I was ever deprived of this, I'd get really angry. I remember if I'd done something and my mother thought I wasn't going to have half hour at the dictionary. But so that's the first time I can remember being delighted in words and pictures and realising it was a very rich experience, and I'd get very excited about it. I wouldn't think about it too much afterwards, but when I was doing it, I remember being very, very excited in some way.
So it sounds like you were leaning towards the arts.
It does, because then when I... Then
oh, you're saying about the church as well.
Yes, because when I went on, I remember the first picture. We had pictures in the house. They were really ordinary pictures, so pictures illustrating pear soap and, a stag on a rock. But I used to really like them, but I realised that there was some quality that we didn't have in the pictures that we had in the house. And when I went to the nuns, the Sacred Heart, I remember clearly there were a lot of Millets there. The Angelus, the Gleaners, and they're all, if you know those pictures, they're suffused by this golden light, and people doing things like gleaning, and the Angelus I sort of understood because they're in some sort of prayer, and we were praying all the time. The Gleaners used to, I couldn't understand what was happening, yet what was happening was very beautiful, and I can remember we'd often sit in front of the Gleaners on a table with our little sin books, and we had these little books that we had to make, and on the left hand we put the good things we did, and on the right we had to make little marks for all the sins. And I remember looking at this, the Gleaners, and just disappearing, because I didn't know that I'd sinned at all, but no, disappear in this painting, and this beautiful golden life, other life, I can remember. And it really did sustain me over... periods. I felt a real sort of help through it in some way. It really sustained me. And so that was the first picture. Yeah, I didn't know.
Well, it sounds like there's a real sense of beauty operating there.
Yes, it was. I didn't know that. I didn't know that word at all, or anything about it, of course. But I remember really some sort of ecstasy at a very primitive level. I was lucky because we had a particular school teacher that would come to, I didn't know any different really, he'd come to school and he'd say, what do we want to do today? He'd ask the students what we want to do today. I went there when I was 9. So often we'd go rabbiting or swimming, or we'd learn to drive his car. Nearly every day There was a big folio of prints that we had on top of a library cupboard. I was allowed to have these prints down, they were big A2 things, and copy them. I drew most of the time for 3 years at this little school. I was allowed to draw and paint. Along with that, there was a fascinating book I remember in the library, The Adventures of Vasco da Gama, that I kept. I'd often get out at the same time as I'd want to do the drawing. I'd get out The Adventures of Vasco da Gama and I'd try and read and understand that, because somehow that fascinated me too. But I'd always, in the end, revert back to painting. So, yeah, look, I did, I suppose, I was practicing to draw all that time. And also at the store, I'd copy a lot of the comics that we came in, you know, Phantom and Donald, all those sorts of material, because I didn't really have books. There was no library up there. There weren't many books in our home. There was plenty of poetry, but no visual material.
It sounds like you didn't get any exposure much to, you know, the classic European art.
No, not at all. I didn't know that artists...
You didn't have any coffee table books or anything like that.
I didn't know that. That was the fascinating thing. When I came back to Melbourne, I came back at about 15. At 16, I used to go to the matinee. And I went to the matinee this day, and there was a film on called Lust for Life about Van Gogh. Yeah. And I'd never heard of Van Gogh. I'd never seen these things. I don't think I knew that it hadn't sunk in that sort of artists existed. I'd seen their pictures, but I hadn't really thought about that. Like, and I went to see this film, and I was just, it was thrilling, you know. I thought, God, is this real or not?
This was Kirk Douglas, wasn't it?
Kirk Douglas, yeah. And it was so passionate, and I thought, I want to be like, you know, I really responded to it. So Monday, I raced off to the Hawthorne Library, found out where the art books were. You know, lo and behold, there were dozen books on this person, Van Gogh. Well, that was that really started me off in earnest, because I learned all about Van Gogh, you know, I read all the letters I did. He became a role model. Copied painting after painting. I'd left high school. I left high school at 14 because I was doing English and history and art, and I enjoyed those things, but on the whole, I didn't enjoy school socially. So
how did you start at work?
My father died when I was 14, so I went out to work in a factory, in a silk screen factory. So I went back to school and did HSC. HSC it was, or matric, HSC. And then went to university, to Monash, for 6 weeks. I'd been practicing art
all through this.
I had, but along with that, I'd been writing a lot. You see, I wrote probably more poetry and stories than I actually painted. If painting was a lot, drawing was a lot easier.
Had you tried exhibiting or publishing or anything?
No, not at that stage. Not till I was about 26 or so. I tried to publish a few poems, and I got them sent back to me and asked to alter a few things. And I was so proud that I wouldn't alter them. So they were never published. But I hadn't painted a lot. But so I thought at the time that I went to university at 26, I was very interested in pursuing some sort of life in English with poetry. I think that was
what sort of poetry were you trying to write?
Well, I suppose it was heavily influenced by the Romantic poets, and then lately Wallace Stevens. I don't know, various Ezra Pound. They were big influences on me. But I was still at 26 using thee and thou. And I remember meeting Finn Buckley, I just went up to Finn Buckley's door one day, this was before university, with some poems, and he said, why are you using these silly words, you know, thee and thou? And it hadn't occurred to me, but so I stopped using them, and there was a strong push to modernise my language, and the Romantics, and then, you know, I was very influenced by those Pound and Stevens and Eliot and similar people, Theodore Ruth. But when I went to university, For those first 6 weeks, all I found myself doing was very lonely, very lonely. I didn't like having to write the sort of essays that I was asked to write or required to write. I liked tutes, but I didn't like... I got restless in lectures, and I found myself just sitting in the library most days, reading the poetry that I hadn't been able to see or read, and listening to recordings. I had recordings of poetry. I wouldn't know what was going on. I really wouldn't. I was totally apolitical because I just lived in this world of poetry mainly and writing poetry. But it was all about, a lot to do with landscape, but love, I suppose, as I perceived it. You know, I was hopelessly and endlessly in love with anonymous faces. And it was just all about some ideal world suffused with love. But
when did Linda come into your life then?
Well, Linda came when I was, quite late, I suppose. A year. Well, I was 30.
What age were you then?
36. I'd gone to university, left university, and then I went to the National Gallery Art School. Again, a very romantic, with a very romantic sort of attitude, because I went there to learn to paint in a certain way, much like traditional painting. And that thing wasn't happening at the gallery school, and I spoke to the chap in charge of painting, Alan Leach Jones, who was then doing tape and spray, was in then, in a very big way, hard edge sort of painting. You know, I wasn't very happy with, because I was still painting very, romantic, figurative sort of, lush sort of painterly things, and this wasn't the,
had you, studied those, you must have studied that style of painting to some degree.
Well, I had
through
just,
that period,
through you? observing and making copies of, of painters that I liked.
And O'Jill playing a Bach fugue. You're listening to The Study, and we're in the studio of Stanley Farley, artist. Stan is a man who can talk about Jackie Wizards and Baudrillard, pickling homegrown olives and Greek music, a contemporary poet, or Keats or Shelley, all of these with equal passion. We continued our conversation with a discussion about art in general.
School of painting. I liked a whole lot of different painting.
Had you very classical, look at the Renaissance?
Yeah, very classical painting. But often I admired Renaissance painting a lot, but often the finish of it was a bit off-putting in that it was often too defined for me. And this was something that I liked, the atmosphere in Romantic painting. Suited my temperament somehow. It was the secular nature, I suppose, of Romantic painting. I don't know if it was anything to do with being brought up a Catholic and having a lot to do with the church as an adolescent and wanting, sidestep the sort of subject matter in a lot of Renaissance painting. I don't think so, but... one of the things, I suppose, about Romantic painting was the great emphasis of landscape within it. That I really responded to. Perhaps I respond to landscape painting more than anything else, and that wasn't a big feature in Renaissance painting. It was in the backgrounds and things, but there wasn't a lot of pure landscape painting. And I think landscape painting was the big attraction.
Looking at art history as a broad thing, I mean, do you think there is any sense of progress in art? Does that mean any... thing at all to progress, or even like a sense of progression, that, that there's an ongoing development.
Yeah.
And I think of, you know, something like the Brunelleschi and single point perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, was that a significant achievement, or was it just like, I mean, those things are really played down these days.
Yes.
We're not supposed to believe in all that. But
yes. I'm sure it was. It was a marvellous invention. Although, I don't prefer that. I mean, I find it a wonderful device, but it's not something that I prefer. There's a lot of painting and drawing that is that doesn't use perspective, and it's still quite wonderful. I mean, it is just as wonderful. But you're talking about progression.
Well, I think like Kenneth Clark in Civilization gave this strong feeling of a story unfolding over a period of 500 years.
Well, I suppose you see ideas being perpetuated and perhaps
That really captured the viewing public too.
Yeah, ideas being developed. But I don't think there's any progress in the arts, because the sorts of small developments that reach fulfillment or go as far as they can go, and then the other little ones go off in a different direction, that's the way I see it. I don't see any progress, because always within the idea of progress, to me, there is some sort of sneaking suspicion that things are better as we progress. I can see that happening sometimes in other fields, but say in science, definitely in technological things, but I suppose it's hard to think of a progression. You can think of a progression of the spirit, but not necessarily, and becoming perhaps more complex or more highly nuanced, but whether it's better or not, I tend not to think of art and progress together. It's just, as you say, we could refine perspective, because the early days of perspective were quite awkward and shaky, and there were some absurd rules that didn't work. But so that I can see a development, but that's a purely technical thing. But I'm more interested in, I suppose, an imaginative portrayal of the world, along with some guidelines, but. And so I don't see any progress in that. I see it going all over the place, up and down, and stopping for a while and starting again. I think they're old, and I think the belief in guidelines and restrictions, I believe in that, and I believe in those, when I say believe, I think they're good things, in as much as they are always, they have some rigour in them, and they divert you from immediate gratification of that self-expressive element that you might think is too dominant in a lot of art now.
I mentioned Kandinsky and his ideas about abstraction and the spiritual in art. Clearly a failure. But he wasn't the only one that sort of had that kind of idea that the Renaissance humanists had this thing that form could reveal the deity. Those sorts of ideas. But in any case, I don't think the 20th century abstraction was successful in doing that. But in any case, all those things seem to have just been thrown aside now. I mean, you can't even discuss this sort of thing now, it seems to me. I don't know what 20th century art achieved at all.
Well,
it's
a lot of questions in
subject.
There.
Yeah, it's very hard to come to grips with.
What you first mentioned about what is art, and what is art?
Well, we've sort of skated past that, but there's the whole thing of the origin of art. Like, it's widely regarded in anthropology, for example. You could strip away everything from human beings.
Mm.
Art will remain to the very end as part of what you think of as humanity. You'll still have some kind of art there.
Yes, there does seem to be. Look, I'm not sure of any of this, of course, and it's something I've thought about a lot. I think about a lot. Because, like, if you're doing something, if you're dancing or singing or whatever you're doing, you can't help but wonder what you're doing. You're doing a lot of these things unconsciously, and you might be doing them for a lot of reasons that you know about, but you often, you know, in a quiet moment, heck, say, get behind all that and wonder why you're doing it and what is it that you're doing it. You want another definition for what you're doing. And I've thought about it a lot, and it looks like it is an innate, if you could, whatever that means, an innate response to being alive. And I think it's got something to do with comfort. You know, it looks like if I could really understand one thing, I understand that human beings want more and more comfort, and I understand that because life is, even a comfortable life, is so tragic in a way, you know, that because we're only alive for a little while, and it's often quite hard to stay alive because there's a lot of things, there's other life forms trying to destroy you, you know, viruses and bacteria and banks and
old age,
right? So there's this terrible urgency and rage to stay alive and to want as much comfort as you can, as you can acquire, and I think that explains why we eat more than we need and acquire more things than we need.
Correct.
It is a rage for, there's this anxiety about being alive, and I understand that. And I think art's one of those things that come out of this idea of comfort. Primitive people seem to have it. Something will be acquired, but then there'll be an added feature that's quite useless on the face of it. You know, a carving or some sort of little pitting or decoration or something that has nothing to do with the use of the thing, but gives a sense of symmetry or comfort. Or it's hard to know. That's the only sense I can make of art. And then I think that thing, that instinct, is developed and sophisticated to the nth degree. On the one hand, art is very useless, but it's useful for those that do it, and a few people that... Very few people. I know very, very few people that really like painting. Very, very few who like it just because they're interested in it. There are a whole lot of other reasons at work, but not many people really like art, I don't think. It has significance for a whole lot of other... I could say the wrong reasons, but other strange reasons. Because it...
Well, it's an interesting observation. I thought a lot of people do like it, but
no,
their reasons aren't very well examined, of course.
No, I don't think they have anything like the experience of art anymore. I'm not thinking for other people, this is not, you know, these are just thoughts I have. Like, if you go to this craze now about blockbuster exhibitions and things like that, I don't think anyone is experiencing the art when they go into those places, and the same for grand tours and things. I think, because a lot of those things were made for contemplation, and they were made to get to know over a long period of time. And if you think of an old picture made, you know, hundreds of years ago before electricity, and it'd be put in the corner of the room, and it would have its own life. You know, it would fade as the sun went down, and come alive again in the morning, and it would be seen in all these different lights. It would become part of the architecture, and it would be loved in so many different ways. I don't think I'm talking about an ideal situation. This is what someone who loved paintings, who loved a piece of landscape or a flower or a cow, would have it there, like a totem thing on the wall, and get to love it in all these different lights and different... And they'd age with it, and it would age with them. That's what a lot of art now can't do, even if I don't think it wants to do it, but it can't do it given the pace of life and given this insistence that we have on change, that I suppose technology has speeded up the amount of change and progress. So we always want, you know, to change the picture, to sell the picture, to get a new picture, to get a new material.
People used to talk about, there was a triumvirate of things with capitals, truth, beauty and good.
Yeah.
The good, they don't seem to matter anymore, any of them, but I think that's sort of what you're talking about, I think.
I suppose we've passed the point where we can sort of contemplate those words with capitals, the way people used to talk about them.
But you
can't get away from those sort of values, I think, if you're going to have values at all.
No, look, I can remember, I've seen the shift in myself, because when I was 14 or so, when I went back to the city, I'd climb up on the top of the house we lived in to watch the sunset over these big oak trees that are at the back. And my mother was very perturbed at this sort of behaviour, and she decided it just wasn't right. She'd come out and throw clods of earth at me to get me off the roof. Anyway, I persisted in this sort of behaviour, and she took me to a clinic, and I can remember arguing with this psychiatrist that I was annoyed and frustrated that I found roses very beautiful, very beautiful, and I could not see, you know, how anyone else could fail to see, because there was beauty in the roses, it was intrinsic, and no one could fail to acknowledge it. You know, it wasn't a matter of how you felt. Beauty really did exist in things, you know, as a property like colour. Well, I no longer believe that, quite like that. I think it's how we, you know, more or less how we perceive things, and anything, just like values, can be changed, and we can choose, as I think Nietzsche says, in so many ways, we can choose our values. If we can choose our values, then we can choose to discard certain values and take on new values. And I believe that up to a point. So those things like truth and beauty, but the other words can be used for those dimensions. And the thing I value about, say, traditional painting is not that it's beautiful. I'm in love with, you might say I'm in love with the technology of it. You know, in love with the restriction that's placed upon someone. You're given a piece of canvas or a board and a pencil and a brush and certain ideas, and you have to make something exceptional with those materials. Now, I mean, everyone knows sort of what exceptional is, just by the sheer effort that one might put into it. And it's that sort of skill and the tradition of the skill, you know, the way that skill continues and the way people value it. And that's what I value, I suppose, about civilization, and that continuing idea of agreeing upon a certain standard, which you could call truth or beauty or anything, but agreeing on it, and to me it's like goodness and human behaviour. You either all agree to respect one another and don't do anything to another person that you don't want done to yourself. You might want to strangle somebody, but you just got to ask yourself, do I want to be strangled? No. And I mean, I think that idea of civilization for me really works. All agreeing upon something. You know, to get back to modern painting now, it's the fact that no one agrees on anything. And so you have a lot of anarchy that has its own conformity, of course, which is not realised, but it's a private language. So if everyone is acting in a way that one can't know about, that only the actor knows, I mean, I don't see the point of civilization. It's not civilization. Look, I've seen, you know, colour field painting sometimes, after I've been looking at Constable or Tintoretto or something, and this beautiful relief of just seeing an enormous patch of blue or red, but it's only for a minute. It's a little bit that wipes things, cleans things, gives you a few moments of ease away from the challenge of it all, and then you go back to it. I mean, it has no lasting value for me, that sort of behaviour. Whatever you want to call art is art. But that's the thing now. If you want to call it art, you can call it art. That's the sort of senseless freedom that you have. But it doesn't mean anything.
No one has to believe it or take any notice.
No, it's that emperor's clothes thing. It's just...
You wouldn't buy it, you wouldn't put it in the house. You wouldn't worship it.
No, you'd worship it as it's worshipped in the gallery as an act of freedom. You know, like people think, and because I'm teaching a tape, you run into this dimension all the time that art still has as an area for freedom. You can't be very free in business or you can certainly can't be free in medicine, and you can't so-called express yourself in a whole lot of areas, but in art you can. So people go into it for this area of freedom that they have, or that they perceive. They can make any marks, they can stamp their foot, and it has authority. And within this arena of art, because art covers such a wide spectrum of things, and they make art. So that's the attractiveness of it. Perhaps in a society that's more and more, with more and more rules, there's more and more art because people want to exercise some sort of freedom. You know, they might want to burn around the block on a car, but they might want to make nasty marks on a bit of canvas.
Well, they make nasty marks on the road, maybe. This is art and folk art of today.
You see, you can't blame these young people. They see the celebrities of their day, the celebrity art people, going into an authoritative space like a museum of contemporary art with the worst sort of excesses. So why not? They can go to art school and do anything. You can't blame them. These are the models that they have. And they have these celebrities with sudden fame and sudden wealth. And they can actually do the same. A lot of the students that I have, they can make equal works to a whole lot of things in contemporary art that's accepted. They're copying them just the same as someone copied a Constable. They're doing the very same thing. These are their models that they've got. That's what I worry about, that you have a whole lot of private languages that anyone can adopt.
I wonder whether it's possible that art, perhaps using technology taken willy-nilly from what is being thrown out by science all the time, you know, we're just inundated with gadgets and computers and all that, whether it might be possible that some new forms of art, completely new forms of art, might appear that, you know, they're not music, they're not what we used to call visual arts, or and whether those arts might really, you know, break through some surface on our existence that we're not.
Yeah.
It was the idea that Clark would say, this idea of a new faculty, a real breakthrough in art would add a new faculty to human ability.
Yes. Yes.
Do you think that
I think that's I do think that's happening. We seem to be moaning, although I seem to be moaning, about the state of art, right? I don't mean to. Really what happens is that I think, and a lot of people have said this, that perhaps art is finished. Art as we knew it is finished. Painting and drawing, you know, things like Admire, Daumier and Constable are finished, which is all right, because in the end, people will do things, like you say, they're searching for new meanings. Now, I can't find any meanings in the lump of plastic or certain materials that are in contemporary art. I can't find any meaning in them for me. You might say, you know, that I'm not moving with the times. I'm probably not, because I'm confused about that. If I move with the times, I suppose I take on another identity, which perhaps I don't want to. My world is very organic. I respond to that. I'm an ancient sort of person because I'm very attached to an organic world that I don't see in a lot of contemporary art. A lot of contemporary art deals with shapes and materials that are very, very new. Right, that a lot of young people live in a world like that, especially an urban world, with a lot of strange surfaces and a lot of different textures, away from an organic, sort of unknown, unstable organic world. So yes, look, those things can died a long time ago, really, but they're still being used. Like Malevich's Black Square was a fantastic thing to do. It was the end of painting. Yet painting's still going on a bit. The squares are being repeated. I suppose it's a bit like the idea of God, even though some people are convinced that there is no God. the whole idea will linger on for a long, long time and keep receding into the background. It will be there for generations. And I suppose the same with the art that I love will linger along, because some people are still doing it. But it will disappear, and there will be this other thing, which I might call art, if I'm very, you know, small-minded. But it is. It's something that someone's trying to find meaning in. All those things, I mightn't find any meaning in. I might go to a contemporary show and I think, you know, Christ, let's go, you know. It's the death of everything.
But I wonder why you bother turning up.
But it is, it does, it must, I hope, have meaning for somebody, for those people that are doing it. But it doesn't for me. So, yeah, things are being created now that perhaps I can't define.
I sort of wonder what it would be like, say, you know, there's a human colony in some big spaceship gone off on star travel and could be gone for a generation if they ever come back. How would they live? You know? They could hardly sort of do landscape painting.
No. Well, no. No, and I think that'll eventually...
I don't know whether that's ever going to happen. I think this century will probably be the one where we've got to bite the bullet as to whether to try that on or we'll give the idea away and look elsewhere for...
Yeah, I strongly believe there'll be new planets, not planets discovered, there'll be ways of habitation in other parts of the universe. I really believe that will happen. And yeah, this old organic world will have been used up, and there'll be this other shining world that I probably wouldn't be able to live in. Which is odd, which is okay. It's okay. Why would I? I wouldn't really want to. I couldn't, you know, say with any intellectual rigor that I wanted, that I want everyone to keep painting like John Constable or something. I don't. It's just that it's my limitation to be stuck with those certain things and not be able to move on.
Marco Abe and David McSkimming with the Debussy Sonata. In the final part of my talk with Stanley Farley, artist, we turn to his own work. He made a large installation in the mid-90s called the Temple of Apollo, which was exhibited in Australia and then later in Greece. He is fond of the sheath of wheat as a subject in painting. He likes Greek things, and in recent years has done a couple of major sculptures coming from his passion for poetry. They take the form of two large urns called the Poet's Bureau and the Vessel of Poetry.
I think that superficial resemblance to Byzantine, especially Byzantine sort of work, is the imitation of shiny surfaces, of light reflecting surfaces. For some reason, I've always been attracted to that. When I started early on, you know, when I was 20 or so, I used to be able to buy little packets that were used in interior decorating of aluminium, gold, bronze powders that you'd mix with a medium. I was fascinated. I bought, I don't know how many kilos of this stuff. I was continually buying at this. You can no longer get those particular things. Those shiny surfaces have always attracted me. I don't know why. I just don't know why. I think, light is very fascinating. And that was a main drive behind the Temple of Apollo, was light. actually using light. Like, I was always fascinated in painting with high contrast and illumination.
This is more important, that, say, than some philosophical
thing it's about more
the Apollonian
principle even though,
of order and form and all that sort of thing.
There are certain things about Byzantine empire that attract me, but it's a very formal thing. I mean, there are things, perhaps it goes back to being a little boy in the church and seeing the tabernacle opened and the reflection of gold, and I really think that and the golden light in the Millais, and there's something about that golden light that has always attracted me and makes just attract me and make me want to participate in it in some way. It seems a very basic sort of concern, light, I suppose. I mean,
especially with that life. Kind of, yeah.
So that was a driving thing behind the Temple of Apollo, and using light underneath the surface to make it translucent.
Well, the other thing about the temple was that you placed it in a sort of Australian rural setting.
Yeah, that gets back to that whole thing.
This is an installation we're talking about.
Yeah. I was fascinated by, like, I think my interest in Greek things was, poetry, architecture. I love architecture, and I suppose I responded to that sort of classical architecture, but also another strong element was Greek, was mythology and the whole pantheon of the gods and all that sort of. Found it very interesting the way, instead of a god, you could have all these aspects that would contain human aspects. So the gods were very human, so that made them very... That was a very attractive idea, the whole Greek god system. But anyway, the temple came out of that idea of civilization. I thought of... Well, I know there's a civilization in Australia. There was a very old civilization still living amongst us. But I never had any contact with that. I think of myself as a European that's stranded out here, right? And I've never responded to...
A possibly superficial interpretation of the work, which we shouldn't make, is that you're saying something about the establishment of civilization in the Australian landscape, and it's Western civilization.
Yes, of course, it's Western civilization, it's the only civilization that I know, you know. And I was thinking about Apollo, and it was just a happy coincidence in a way. It's a thing I never thought out. It's a thing that just happened. Apollo, because he's the god of the muses, and he's the bringer of art, and poetry and all those things that civilize people. It's again getting back to the idea of beauty and goodness and all that are supposed to, art's supposed to have these influences of goodness and beauty and correctness and so on. Well, Apollo is the custodian of that, as against the Dionysian Rothko, whatever, who demolishes everything and sweeps everything away.
Deconstructs.
Yeah, exactly. Deconstructs. So I just thought of the Apollo in Australia. You know, which is an absurd idea. But so it was just that interest in Apollo and the interest in light, because Apollo has many attributes, and one of them is light, clarity. You know, the clarity of civilization, the way it's, you know, we have rules and so on. And it's the clarity of it all, the way it can predict futures and everything, as against this chaos and anarchy that we need sometimes, of the other, you know. And I thought, well, you know, I obviously can't construct a landscape in... I want to look at Australian landscape. So I looked at the colours of Australia and agricultural implements and so on that occurred within Australia, but within a sort of... classical dimension, you know, and I used the temple at Didyma, which was a very seminal temple for prophecy, and where the temple of Apollo, and used those exact dimensions and all that within an Australian landscape. Wheat to me. I was brought up with wheat, and so wheat symbolised, and that whole, the idea of the Eleusinian mysteries where so many people were taken down into a dark subterranean chamber and threatened they were not to say what they were about to see, and an ear of wheat was held up, you know, by the priest. That is such a glorious idea, because again, it's that reverence and care for the earth. It's care about a grain that you're totally dependent upon. And so there's all these ceremonies about it. And I guess the Catholic Church echoes that, the way the host of bread is held up as a source of sustenance and light. That's much the same thing, I suppose. So the sheaf, yes, it's just a beautiful shape. The way it gathers at the base, it has a large base, and it goes up slowly into this, narrows and is constrained by a rope, and then bursts out again. It's so exciting, shape, you know. But it has those meanings too.
You had a near fatal accident, which had a big influence on your work for at least a certain period of your life when I first met you, probably, 15 or so years ago. And a major canvas from that period is sitting right behind you on the wall there now. Can you talk a bit about that?
It was a good thing in a way, I suppose. I see the positive side of it, because at the time I was doing a lot of things apart from making pictures. I was making pictures, but not many. I was building a house. Then I had that accident, which laid me up for a long time and had to learn to walk again. And so I thought, well, my labouring days and those days of, enjoying work, I enjoyed work, labouring, working physically very much outdoors and farm work and all that. I thought, that's finished, really, and so there'll have to be more concentration on making pictures and things, which once that had been decided for me, that was good. And so then for years after that, because I had a few some injuries that scarred my legs, I did a whole series of pictures for years, I suppose, about the landscape here, the local landscape, and parts of myself in the landscape. And the landscape, it gave me opportunity to focus in on a whole lot of small parts of the landscape, seeds and bits of past, civilizations like farms and farm implements and things that were going back into the earth but were still sort of visible.
And but some of this looks like a sort of dreamscape of a badly injured man.
Yes, it does. They're rather dangerous landscapes where some, bad accidents could happen. But they're not thoroughly...
You've got a picture here with a heart sort of hanging out in the middle of the clearing.
Oh, yeah, that's the two hearts.
Two hearts
are better than one,
But, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of blood-red paint in that series, as I remember it.
Yes. Well, that picture sums a lot up for me in a way, because this is one of the last ones I did from that period. And it's a sort of a figure of some kind, shamanistic figure of some kind, holding a banner, a golden banner up. And on a banner are two words that... Holdren said in his madness, he kept repeating, Palashk, Palashk. I've never heard it said, but it's something. I think it's pronounced like that. It means nothing. It doesn't occur in the German language. But it meant for Holdren, yes, no. And I was very attracted to that, because it sort of, even though I'm dogmatic, or I appear dogmatic, it's always there, yes and no, continually hovering above my head.
Yeah. Okay, well, mentioning Holden, the other big thing about your recent work, to me at least, is where you've really brought out your interest in poetry, a series of Greek urns in particular, two in particular, the Poets Bureau, and remind me what's
that? The Vessel of Poetry.
Vessel of Poetry, where your love of poetry's
Paramount.
Paramount.
poetry has always been there, and it was always a problem earlier on because people wanted to know you either as someone that wrote poetry or someone that made pictures or someone that danced. It was very hard to be credible writing poems and painting. One always had to be better or first. It never felt like that to me. They were both lived well with one another. But I felt that I had to make some sort of choice to spend more time doing one thing and another, just as that. But poetry, well, poetry has always been a very essential part of my life. Again, as a kid, I remember reading, first read Wordsworth and Keats and Shelley. And that trinity of poets was all I needed for many years. Because poetry had this intense, was easily able to transport you, especially lyric poetry. This virtual world could easily consume you, you know, and you'd be immediately in this intense frenzy. And I see the desire for art like that, the desire to be lifted out into this, taken into this, onto this ecstatic plane. This is what it's like. And lyric poetry does that for me. It's just a beautiful way of responding to the world, the world.
Sympathetic to the idea that Stan discussed about the ability of art to transport one to another plane. That painting, say, can do something similar to poetry and music. I guess I find frustration about how hard it seems to be to find that with contemporary art, which often aims for the exact opposite effect. Then, of course, there's the issue of why you want to be transported anyway. But there are many questions around the complex nature of art. In my study, to go into one question, over on the project table, I have had for some time a folder with a working title of ontological security, or perhaps it should be insecurity, if I can explain with a couple of examples. The first, there's a classic old colonial travelogue book called A Pattern of Islands by Sir Arthur Grimble, a one-time governor of Kiribati in the South Pacific in the days when it was called the Gilbert Islands. On his way out there as a young man in 1914, he stopped at Ocean Island, now called Banaba. This island is situated all alone in the vast ocean, hundreds of kilometres from its nearest neighbours, Nauru and the Gilberts. It's a place you'd be hard put to find even with a map. Grimble himself contributed to a fascinating literature about how the Polynesian sailors could navigate by their intimate understanding of clouds and wave patterns. The island is a coral reef perched on an old volcanic peak that rises steeply off the ocean, the deep ocean floor, 2,000 fathoms below. When the great ocean swells are running, they shake this little island. The old fisherman would whisper, "Behold, Tabakia moves a little." Tabakia was the great turtle who lived at the bottom of the sea and balanced that column of rock on his back. They believed that one day he would move too much and topple it over and engulf the island in the roaring waters. But, as Grimble tells us, and I quote, "the thought did not trouble them mightily, for they knew that their hero ancestor, the far voyager, the all-conquering warrior and lover, Owl of the Rising Sun, would see them safely through the end. Every new dawn was his repeated guarantee of that, so when someone whispered, 'Tabakia moves a little,' it was enough to answer, the sun rises for everyone to be comforted again. The second example is the Aztecs. In her book of that name, Inga Glendinnen describes how they lived in abundance most of the time, yet represented themselves as living on a razor's edge, how they saw themselves as toiling along a windswept ridge and abyss on either hand, ever fearful the sun would not rise the next day. We know well enough how the Aztecs responded to this perception of their existence. With a frenzied paranoia, they built a culture of human sacrifice that reached an industrial scale. For me, at least, their cruelty was of a similar order to the Nazis, and for reasons that were no more justifiable, coming as it did in both cases from a people with a highly developed polity and a culture of art and beauty. Glendinnen doesn't attempt a definitive explanation of this ontological paranoia. She refers to a book called The Sons of the Shaking Earth. The author, Eric Wolfe, discusses the geological volcanic environment characterized by frequent seismic shocks and the rough climate of the Mexican Plateau. But there have long been people, and many today, living around volcanoes. A shaking earth was the only kind the Bannerbans knew. We can think here too of the kind of attitude to life and the cosmos found expressed in a book like Black Elk Speaks, perhaps a bit of a New Age classic. This would be closer to the Bannerbans than the Mexica. Yet the literature on North American Indian culture persuades me that they lived in a cultural continuum. That is, the Lakota of the northern prairies were not a people separated by any genetic or cultural chasm from their Mexica cousins. So my question is, what is it that makes one people react to the human condition with a calm acceptance, with confidence, not fear, and another with a sustained frenzy of murder and cruelty? At least part of the answer, I think, is in the stories we tell ourselves. We are a bit like the Bannerbans today on our little planet. Do we tell ourselves stories about what? Survival or inevitable extinction? We don't really seem to have much of a story to tell at all now. We keep busy waiting for the next version of Windows or the next gadget. Will Steve Jobs release a phone combined with a vibrator so you can dial 1300 for a thrill? Well, I don't have any definitive answer either, but I do feel that the job of art ought to be to tell the stories. It should find them and tell them and retell them. Maybe it's too much like hard work, but to me that is more important than self-expression, more important than pushing accepted boundaries, breaking down the barriers, challenging preconceptions or any of the other tedious cliches one often reads in writing about contemporary art. Anyway, ontological security is a file that will have to stay put for a long time yet. Stan Farley's last major exhibition was Hairst at Gallery 101 in Collins Street, Melbourne. Music in this program included Jacqueline O'Gill playing a Bach fugue, and Miwako Abe and David McSkimming playing the finale of a Debussy sonata. And our usual themes, the Bach Prelude with Ronald Farren Price and the Handel Suite with Elizabeth Anderson, all on Move Records. Full details are on the study website at www.thestudy.net.au. And so, until next time, shut the door and reading lamp only in the study.